This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Angela Merkel's Bavarian coalition partner goes down to a thumping defeat in state elections in Bavaria over the weekend, casting Angela Merkel, the strong leader in Europe, her government into doubt in the coming weeks. And meanwhile, China accelerates its repression of its Muslim Uyghur minority in the west of the country. The rest of the world is starting to take notice. This is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, coming to you from our luxury podcasting studio on the banks of the River Thames in London. I am in for Mary Kissel again. And talking Bavaria and China with me today is my colleague Hugo Restall, who is on the line from Asia. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Joe. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's great to be back here talking about global chaos and disorder. And we are actually going to start in a country that is not known for being chaotic or disorderly, Germany. So listeners by now might be aware that over the weekend we had a state-level election in Bavaria, which is the very conservative state right at the south of Germany. Germany provides us a rolling electoral calendar for its state elections, so you have one whether you want them or not every few months. And the big news here, Hugo, is that the Conservative Party, the Christian Social Union, or CSU, who are the sister party for Angela Merkel's own Christian Democratic Union and the rest of the country, have suffered one of their worst election results at the state level in Bavaria since democracy was restored in Western Germany in the late 40s, early 50s. The CSU has fallen to about a 37% vote share. I think in the previous election, they had been up somewhere in the 48 neighborhood. They are still the largest party in the state-level parliament, but they have lost their outright majority there. They're going to have to form a coalition. You know, this election result I thought was so interesting because it was cast as a real referendum on Merkel's refugee policy. The CSU had felt under pressure from the Alternative for Germany and anti-migrant party on the right. And yet, come to find out, the big winners here are actually the Green Party on the left. They have come in, second or third with about 18% of the vote. And, that is a terrific result for them, doubling their share over the last time. It's raising this question about whether what we thought we knew about German politics, the politics of migration, was right, or whether voters are thinking about other things.
Right. The polls before this election were pretty accurate in terms of the CSU being polling, I think they were around 35% predictions. But the Green victory is quite a surprise. Why were we taken by surprise on that front?
Well, I think that, polls had been starting to show that they were creeping up. I think that what is probably going to surprise people is where these Green voters have come from. A lot of them are actually coming from the Conservative Party, the CSU. One of the reasons that its vote tally fell is because some of those voters weren't going to the Alternative for Germany, the AfD party on the far right. They were actually shifting further to the left, to a party that is very explicitly pro-migration, very environmentalist. That always plays very well in Germany. But actually, really tried to sidestep the migration issue as much as possible. They were talking about the Greens were to the party that wanted to do something about rapidly rising house prices, about protecting the countryside that Bavarians view as a local treasure. I think that what you've got is this real realignment where we've thought for a long time that the mainstream center-right parties like the CDU, like the CSU, were coming under pressure from the far right. It looks like they're under pressure from everywhere.
Right. And you were saying to me earlier that the Greens are not as far left as you might from a typical Green party across Europe. In Germany, the Greens, they tend to be lefty on social issues, right?
Yeah, I think that the Green Party in Germany is an interesting animal because Green parties in most parts of the developed world are usually associated with a very far-left economic and social agenda. Of course, the environmentalism is an important part of it. But in Germany, what has been developing is that the Greens have been positioning themselves more as a urban, sort of culturally left-leaning party. But on the economics, there may be a little more reasonable compared at least to other Green parties elsewhere. And one of the interesting things I've been tracking is the extent to which the Greens have actually been succeeding in attacking crony capitalism. That's a big theme for them, particularly in a country where you've had a bunch of scandals involving companies, especially the Dieselgate scandal in the auto industry. It has been particularly bruising it and exposed a lot of political connections between both the center-right and the mainstream center-left party, the Social Democrats or the SPD. The Greens have been presenting themselves, especially to urban voters, but also to some people out in the countryside, as a good governance party. And that is a really interesting approach that seems to be resonating here.
Right. So it's a fatigue with the two mainstream parties is what I'm sensing here.
Yeah, I think that's probably the right way to describe it. And the fatigue is an interesting way of thinking about this, because we've often thought about these debates really in policy terms. And the issue has been, do voters care about economic policy? Do they care about migration policy? What are the specific things that mainstream parties could do that would cater to these new voter concerns? Now I find myself wondering, not just in Germany, but in a lot of places around Europe, whether actually it's just more of an emotional fatigue issue. No matter what the mainstream parties say to voters now, the voters are just anxious for something different.
So where does the CSU go from here? Where does Angela Merkel go?
Well, I think the CSU is gearing itself up for a major leadership fight, because they've had two big contenders emerging. One is a Horst Seehofer, who is the federal interior minister in Berlin and has been the CSU's leader. We talked about him on this podcast over the summer when he was feuding with Angela Merkel over migration policy, because he thought that the government needed to tack much further right in order to see off the threat from the Alternative for Germany party. At the state level, you have a fellow named Markus Söder, who is the leader of the state government in Bavaria, also a CSU member. They were both out of the gates pretty quickly after these election results came out Sunday night, blaming each other for the problem and trying to escape responsibility. But, I think the bigger point here is going to be, can any politician who is really tied up in the party or has been bound into this party apparatus for a long time, if what the voters are saying they want is something new, if they're saying that they are fatigued with old style politics, is it just a matter of finding the right that kind of leader, or do they need to find some way to look further outside of their ranks than maybe German parties have been accustomed to doing in the past?
And Angela Merkel, what does she take away from this?
Well, I don't think that she's going anywhere soon. I think that the real significance for her here is just that, all of a sudden, within about the past 6 months or so, people who had thought that her government was going to last for at least another 2 years or so before the knives started coming out and people started jockeying to replace her, now all of a sudden that seems to be happening very quickly. And it's happening at an important time for both Germany and the rest of the EU. Probably a lot of other European leaders are looking at this with a fair amount of alarm, because they've been hoping that as we reach a critical stage of Brexit negotiations and face the prospect of an Italian debt fiasco, as the new insurgent government in Rome starts putting the finishing touches on their budget, people have probably been inclined to look to Berlin, hoping that there would be stability there. Now maybe there won't be. Maybe Germans are saying that they actually want a little bit more competition in Berlin, and maybe German voters are finding ways to push for that competition, whether Berlin wants to give it to them or not. We've been talking about the changing tides and currents of German politics, and this is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from the Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, still in for Mary Kissel this week. I'm joined on the line by my colleague Hugo Restall in Asia. And Hugo, we're going to go to your part of the world now to talk about China. Now, this is an issue that we've discussed on this podcast in the past. China's, I suppose one could call it a growing or an accelerating repression of the Muslim minority population in the west of the country, in Xinjiang. Province, the Uyghurs are the Muslim ethnic group at issue here. And, you know, we've been having a lot of reports, you know, over the past few months about you know, how Beijing is starting to move large numbers, shockingly large numbers of Uyghurs into re-education camps to try to stamp out, you know, after many decades of trying in various forms or you know, various forms to try to suppress Uyghur cultural identity. You know, Beijing seems to be ratcheting up that effort in a major way. You know, last week we had an attempt actually from Beijing, if you can believe it, to try to legalize some of these camps by, you know, passing a law that suggested that maybe Beijing would have a legal authority to do this. That seems to be prompting a lot of people outside of the country to pay attention. And I think that the big question here has to be what is going on. I mean, why is it that you know, Beijing suddenly feels emboldened to be continuing down this path? And the more and more controversial it becomes internationally, the more pressure, you know, for example, members of the United States Congress try to place on Beijing for this, the more Beijing really seems to be digging in its heels on this.
Right. So there's a shifting defense going on. You could call it the shifting defense of the indefensible, really. They started out saying that these were vocational training camps for petty criminals, and that re-education camps didn't exist. This was just something the West was making up. Since then, we've seen gradual shift. One part of it, as you mentioned, was the amendment of the law in Xinjiang to allow the use of vocational schools to de-radicalize Islamic extremists. So that was retroactive and basically was an attempt to legalize what they had been doing. Although in many respects, the use of these camps is still illegal according to China's own laws. And then we've had a couple of officials come out and make defenses of the policy. One of them was Yu Quan, official in the United Front Work Department, which oversees minority policy, talking about sinicization, that the sinicization of minorities must go on. And this includes language, culture, dress, et cetera, and religion, of course. You know, this was beneficial for society and necessary. Just in the last day, we've had another official in Xinjiang, Shorat Zakir, make a full-throated defense of the camps, saying that they're necessary to reform people who have been influenced by terrorism and extremism, get them to accept modern science and enhance their understanding of Chinese history and culture. So I think what's been going on behind the scenes was really laid out pretty well by a scholar named James Leibold, who wrote on the Jamestown Foundation's website and talked about the theory that has sprung up in the last few years about how to handle minorities in China. And this, there's an official named Hu Lianhe who actually mounted the initial defense of the camps in Geneva, in which he denied that there were re-education camps. But he is the theorist behind this new policy. He's come up with his own theory of stability, which basically requires not just focusing on religion, but material and economic development, political, cultural, spiritual, and ideological issues that affect stability. He calls for the standardization of human behavior, chillingly Orwellian language. And basically, it's a comprehensive systems engineering project, in their terms, where they can manufacture stability through the right blend of governance tools, including these camps. So that is the underpinning of this. And really, the Uyghurs are the most prominent victims of the new policy, but they will not be the only policy. It's pretty clear that this is going to be rolled out for all minorities across China in one form or another. And instead of celebrating, the different costumes and languages that as the communist government actually did for the last 50 odd years, they're going to force minorities to speak standard Chinese, wear standard dress, and fit in every respect with the rest of the population.
I mean, this really, it is hard to fathom how extraordinary this story is that something like this is happening in the 21st century, because, you know, we're living in a political environment in many parts of the Western world where, you know, comparisons or slurs about political opponents being like the Nazis get thrown around, willy-nilly and without any kind of seriousness or, you know, thought given to how serious an allegation or suggestion that kind of thing is. But this actually seems to me an awful lot like the kind of environment that you found, under the Nazi regime in Europe in the 30s and 40s, because, you know, certainly there is not the death camp element of this, but you can see a lot of elements of, you know, trying to gin up security fears where there aren't really any, because I don't think that anyone is going to claim that China has, you know, any sort of substantial problem with Islamist terrorism in the same way that many other parts of the world do.
They've had attacks, but not, yeah, it's not a crisis. Certainly the attacks that they've had have been of a very small and manageable scale.
And you have in the Uyghurs a minority religious population that has managed more or less to, you know, coexist with a very hostile Communist Party regime for, decades now. And you have this conclusion on the part of the regime in the country that now all of a sudden this religious minority constitutes some sort of threat to the broader society, and that the solution to this is to encamp people and then try to re-educate them. I mean, I suppose the big difference here between what China is claiming that they are doing and the situation in Europe in the 30s or 40s is that they're is, in theory, some attempt to kind of re-educate and then what release the Uyghurs back into, you know, Chinese civilization robbed of any of their unique cultural heritage. But, I mean, it is, you know, listeners really should understand, and we are talking millions of people here, so this is not a small group either that is being affected by this, and that makes it all the more remarkable to me that Beijing thinks that they can get away with this, that they seem to be prepared right. to discuss this on the world stage and even, you know, think that they can sanction it by, reconfiguring their laws to make it legal somehow.
Right. So just to give some context to this, in July, the Global Times newspaper, which is owned by the Communist Party, reported that there were 1.26 million Uyghurs in the re-education camps, then called vocational training camps, in Xinjiang. So that's pretty much in line with what the scholars have said about the capacity of these camps, which I think it's definitely fair to call them concentration camps. They are, you know, heavily guarded, you know, barbed wire, very Spartan conditions. The inmates complain of not being well fed. And being mistreated, being held in solitary confinement, being tortured, and they've been separated from their children very significantly. The children have been moved to separate facilities, and there's a transfer going on of prisoners from these camps to other prisons, regular prisons in the rest of China, because the camps are over capacity. which is, again, quite alarming, given that these camps have a capacity of more than a million people. So the Uyghurs are being moved into regular high-security prisons with ordinary criminals in the rest of China, which suggests that the supposed training that is being offered is not significant. I mean, the officials are claiming that life in the camps is wonderful and that the Uyghurs are being exposed to things that they never had access to before, but like sports and music. And the tales that the few people who emerge from these camps tell is a very different story. It's very stark mistreatment that they undergo there.
You know, I want to work around to a conclusion about some of the potential for perhaps international players to exert some pressure in Beijing to try to ease the situation, let up the pressure on the Uyghurs. But I want to get there by way of what I think is an important issue to talk about in the context of the Communist Party regime in China, which is its stability and the extent to which there might be a perception within the regime in China that perhaps it is less stable than people on the outside tend to think. And that might be a controversial point for me to raise. I think the reason that I would ask that kind of question is because the picture that emerges on the Uyghur repression that is currently underway is that the regime feels under some kind of pressure from the existence of this large religious minority in a big part of a geographic area of China to the west. This is happening at the same time that the state apparatus of political censorship on the Han Chinese ethnic majority within the country continues apace, so that they continue to be extremely skittish about any kind of political discussion that might challenge the regime in any way. And they're also coming under a fair amount of economic stress to do with the Trump administration's trade policies and the potential implications of that for the Chinese economy. I mean, am I right thinking that actually what we are seeing are some signs of a regime that might, this isn't necessarily a sign of strength, it's a sign of concern about the stability of the regime, and that actually potentially creates some pressure points or some opportunities for people outside who are concerned about this, political figures like Trump or European leaders, to start raising some of these instances a little more vigorously?
Well, I think you're definitely onto something there in terms of this regime is not inherently stable. This crackdown parallels another crackdown going on against Christianity in the rest of China. And it's also coinciding with the rise of a cult of personality around Xi Jinping. In fact, there are reports that museums and textbooks are removing mentions of Deng Xiaoping, the father of reform and opening up, and replacing him with more encomiums to Xi Jinping. So, and of course, Xi Jinping's policies are quite different from Deng Xiaoping's. He's more about control and closing down access to the outside world rather than opening up. So, I think this current regime is looking increasingly brittle. But I would caution against interpreting this crackdown and others as being signs of short-term weakness or response to the Trump tariff. I think this is something that is endogenous to the Chinese political system, where their great vulnerability is the inability to handle internal conflict within the party and determine who the successors will be and how to manage factional conflict. And so Xi Jinping has come in initially expected to be another consensus leader and has turned out to be a dictator and has consolidated his power over all aspects of policy and has eclipsed all of his colleagues in the upper rank of the Communist Party. So that sows the seed of instability for China's future. But in the short term, I expect there to be less and less room for dissent or any kind of civil society or development of China's political institutions.
Well, we have been talking about China's repression of its Muslim Uyghur minority, but we're going to have to leave it there for today. We have covered about as much global disorder as we have time for in this podcast. So I'm going to thank my colleague Hugo Restall for joining, and please follow him on Twitter at Hugo Restall, all one word. I am Joseph Sternberg, also from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and I am on Twitter at Joseph Sternberg, all one word. Give us a shout. We'd love to know what you think of the podcasts. And thank you for listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.